There was a comment on the last post that made me remember an event from my childhood that I always took as odd, but never really considered it to be related to any of these stories. I know now that it is. But, I don't know, it's funny how memories work, right? The details might all be present in your mind, though scattered and disarrayed, and then a single thought can stitch them back together almost instantly. I never thought of these events much because I was focused on the wrong details. I went back to my mom's house and went through my old childhood schoolwork, looking for something that I might think is important. I couldn't find it, but I kept looking. Again, I'm sorry for the length. Most old cities and the neighborhoods in them weren't planned with the thought that the population would begin to grow exponentially and it would have to be accommodated. The layout of the roads is originally in response to geographical restrictions and the necessity of connecting points of economic importance. Once the connecting roads were established, new businesses and roads are positioned strategically along the existing skeleton, and eventually the paths carved into the earth are immortalized in asphalt, leaving room only for minor modifications, additions, and alterations, but never a dramatic change. My childhood neighborhood must have been old, then. If straight lines move as the crow flies, then my neighborhood must have been built based on the travels of a snake. The first houses built must have been placed around the lake, and gradually the inhabitable areas increased as new extensions were built off the original path. These new extensions all ended abruptly at one point or another. There was only one entrance or exit for the entire neighborhood. Many of these extensions were limited by a tributary, which both fed and drank from the lake and passed right by what I call, well, have called in these stories, the ditch. Many of the original homes had enormous yards, but some of those original plots had been divided, leaving properties with smaller and smaller boundaries. An aerial view of my neighborhood would give one the impression that an enormous squid had once died in the woods, and some adventuring entrepreneur found the corpse and paved roads under its tentacles, only to withdraw his involvement and leave time, greed, and desperation to divide up the land amongst prospective homeowners like an embarrassing attempt at the golden ratio. From my porch, you could see the old houses that surround the lake, but the house of Mrs. Maggie was my favorite. She was, that, as best as I can remember, around 80 years old, but despite that, she was one of the friendliest people I'd ever met. She had a head of loose-set white curls and always wore light dresses with floral patterns. She talked to me and Josh from her back porch when we were swimming in the lake, and she always invited us in for snacks. She said that she was lonely because her husband Tom was always away on business, but Josh and I would always decline her invitation because as nice as Mrs. Maggie was, well, there was always something that was still a bit odd about her. See, every now and then, we would sim away and she would say, "Chris and John, you're welcome here anytime." We could hear her still yelling that when we were walking back into my house. Mrs. Maggie, like many others, had a sprinkler system that was on a timer. Though at some point over the years, her timer must have broken because the sprinklers would come on at various points during the day and often even at night all year. While it never got cold enough to snow very much, several times each winter I would go outside in the morning to see Mrs. Maggie's yard transformed into a surreal Arctic paradise by the frozen water. Every other yard stood sterilized and dry by the biting frost of the winter cold, but right there in the middle of the bleak reminder of the savagery of the season was an oasis of beautiful ice, hanging like stalactites from every branch of every tree and every leaf of every bush. As the sun rose, it reflected off, and each piece of ice splintered the sun into a rainbow. It would only be viewed briefly before it blinded you. As a child, I was struck by how beautiful it was. And once Josh and I would go over there and walk on the ice grass and have sword fights with the icicles. I once asked my mom why she left it on like that. My mom seemed to search for the explanation before she said, "Well, sweetie, Mrs. Maggie's sick a lot, and sometimes when she gets really sick, she gets confused. And that's why she messes up yours and Josh's name sometimes. She doesn't mean to, but sometimes she just can't remember. She lives in that big house all by herself, so it's okay if you talk to her when you swim the lake. But when she invites you in, you should keep saying no. I mean, be polite. Her feelings won't get hurt. But she'll be less lonely when her husband comes home, right? How long will we be away on business? Seems like he's always away." My mom struggled, and I could see that she had become very upset. And finally she answered, "Honey, Tom's not going to come home. Tom's in heaven. He died years and years ago, but Mrs. Maggie doesn't remember. She gets confused and forgets, but Tom's not ever coming home. If someone moved back in with her, she might even think it was Tom. But he's gone, sweetie." I would have only been around 5 or 6 when she told me, and while I didn't understand it completely, I was still profoundly sad for Mrs. Maggie. I know now that Mrs. Maggie had Alzheimer's. She and her husband Tom had 2 sons, Chris and John. The two had worked out payment plans with the utility companies and paid for Mrs. Maggie's water and electricity, but they would never visit her. I don't know if something happened between them, or if it was the illness, or if they just lived too far away, but they never came around. I had no idea what they looked like. There were times when Mrs. Maggie must have thought Josh and I looked like they did when they were children. Or maybe she saw what some part of her mind wanted so desperately to see. Ignoring the images transmitted down her optic nerve, and just for a little while, showing her what used to be, I realize only now how lonely she must have been. During the summer after kindergarten, before the events of balloons, Josh and I had taken to exploring the woods near my house, as well as the tributary of the lake. We knew that the woods between our houses were connected, and we thought that it would be neat if the lake near my house was somehow connected to the creek around his, so we resolved ourselves to find out. We were going to make maps. The plan was to make 2 separate maps and then combine them. We'd make 1 map exploring the area around the creek near his house and make another following the outflow from my lake. Originally, we were going to make 1 map, but we realized that wasn't possible, since I had started drawing the map of my area so huge that the route from his house wouldn't have even been to scale. We kept the map from the lake at my house and the map from the creek at his house, and we would add to each when we stayed the night at each other's. For the first couple of weeks, it went really well. We would walk through the woods along the water and pause every couple of minutes to add to the map, and it seemed like the 2 maps would come together any day. We had no equipment needed for the job, not even a compass, but we tried to make do. We had the idea to impale the earth with a stick when we had reached the end of a venture, so that if we came upon the stick from the other direction the next weekend, we would know we had joined the maps. We might have been the world's worst cartographers. Eventually, however, the woods became too thick near the water coming from the lake, and we were unable to proceed further. We lost interest in the whole project for a bit and reduced our explorations significantly, though not completely, when we started selling the snow cones. After I showed my mom all the pictures I had taken home from school and she took away my snow cone machine, our interest in the maps revitalized. We'd come up with another plan. Although I didn't understand why, my mom had placed what I considered to be an extremely severe restriction on what I could do and where I could go, and I had to check in frequently if I had went outside to play with Josh. This meant that we couldn't stay in the woods for hours and continue to look for a new path. We thought that we could just swim when we got to the cutoff in the woods, but that clearly wouldn't work since the map would get wet. We tried going faster when we were coming from Josh's house, but we eventually ran into the same problem. And then, we had a brilliant idea. We'd build a raft. Due to the construction in the neighborhood, there were large amounts of scrap building materials that the company would set in the ditch to keep it out of the road and off-site since they had no need for it for the building. We originally conceived of a formidable ship complete with a mast and an anchor, but this quickly diminished into something more manageable. We set aside the wood, took several large pieces of styrofoam that were backed with foam board, and tied them together with rope and kite string. We launched our vessel a little down the water from Mrs. Maggie's and waved a farewell to her as she motioned us to come back her way. But there was no stopping us. The raft worked very well, and while we both behaved and spoke as if the functionality of the raft was a given, I know at least I was a little surprised. We each had a fairly large tree branch to use as a paddle, but we found it was easier to simply push along the land under the water than actually use them as intended. When the water became too deep, we'd simply lie on our stomachs and use our hands to paddle the water, which still worked, albeit less well. The first time that we had to resort to that method of propulsion, I remember thinking that from far above, it must have looked like a colossal fat man with tiny arms was out for a swim. It actually took us several trips to get the raft to the passable patch of woods that marked the farthest that we had ever made it. And after we'd come up with the idea of marking the ground with a stick, we had taken to running through the woods until we got to the stick, and then, as carefully and precisely as we knew how, charting our course. This meant that the impasse was actually quite a bit away. So to sail from around my house all the way to the blockade in the woods was taking longer than expected. We'd sail for a bit and dock the raft, and then next time we'd run through the woods to the raft and go a little further. We continued this well into first grade. Josh and I were assigned to different groups that year, so since we didn't really see each other during the school day, our parents were more willing to let us hang out all weekend. Each weekend. What's more, Josh's dad had taken on a lengthy construction job that required him to work over the weekends, and his mom was on call, so that meant Josh would stay at my house most every weekend for weeks on end. We should have been making excellent progress. But when we finally made it to the impasse and had the opportunity to explore past it, we couldn't find a place to dock the raft. The woods were simply too thick. The water had eroded the land to the point that there was nearly a 2-foot rise of earth over the tributary, which exposed the twisting and damp roots of the trees above. We'd have to turn back every time and leave the raft at the same thick of trees that prompted us to build it in the first place. Even worse, winter had arrived, so we couldn't justify leaving the house in our swimsuits. We were getting nowhere. We always had to come home before we could gain much ground. On Saturday around 7 p.m., Josh and I were playing when one of my mom's coworkers knocked on our door. Her name was Samantha, and I remember her well now because, well, I would propose to her a couple years later when I was visiting my mom at work. My mom said that she had to go to work to fix a problem that had arisen, and that she'd be back in about 2 hours. Her car was being repaired, so she'd have to ride with Samantha, but I gathered that the problem was Samantha's fault, and discussing it in the car was why it would take 2 hours. She said that under no circumstances were we to leave the house or open the door for anyone. And she was in the middle of explaining that she would call every hour when she got there to check in, but ended that statement prematurely when she remembered that our phone had been turned off for delinquent payments. This was why Samantha had just come by unannounced. She looked me dead in the eye as she was closing my door and said, "Stay put." This was our chance. We watched her drive down the serpentine road toward the exit, and as soon as the car rounded the last visible bend, we ran back to my room. I dumped my backpack out while Josh grabbed the map. "Hey, do you have a flashlight?" No, but we'll be back way before dark. I was thinking, just in case. We should have one. My mom has one. I don't know where she keeps it. Wait. I ran into my closet. I pulled a box down from the top shelf. "Do you have a flashlight in there?" Josh asked. "Not exactly." I opened the box and revealed 3 Roman candles that I'd taken from a pile that my mom had amassed for the 4th of July that past summer, along with a lighter that I managed to take from her some months before. This would ensure that we at least had some light if we needed it. This was a little bit before I had been given an opportunity to be afraid of the woods at night. So it wasn't fear that motivated our search for a light source, only practicality. We threw it all in the backpack and bolted out the back door, making sure to close it so boxes wouldn't get out. We had 1 hour and 50 minutes. We ran through the woods as fast as we could and made it to the raft in about 15 minutes. We had our bathing suits on under our clothes, so we stripped off our shirts and shorts and left them in 2 separate piles about 4 feet from the edge of the water. We untied the raft from the trees, grabbed our branch paddles, and cast off. We tried to move rapidly to reach a point beyond the content of our ever-expanding map, as we didn't have time to waste seeing old sights. We knew that we were slower in the raft than on land, and that we would be in the raft for quite a while after the cutoff since the woods were too thick to walk through, and there wasn't a place to dock. This meant that we'd have to ride the raft back to the original docking site, even if we found a new place to dock it further ahead. After we passed the last charted part of the map, the water began to get really deep, and eventually, we could no longer touch the bottom with our tree branches. So we lay on our stomachs and we paddled with our hands. It was getting darker, and as a result, it was becoming harder to distinguish the trees from one another, and we were both becoming slightly unnerved. In the interest of making good time, we were paddling fast with our arms, but this caused a lot of noise as our hands repeatedly confronted and then broke through the water's surface tension. During these periods, we could both hear the crunching of dead leaves and the snapping of fallen sticks in the woods to our right. As we would slow our pace and quiet our actions, the rustling in the woods would cease, and we began to wonder if it was ever really there at all. We didn't know what kind of animals resided this far into the woods, but we did know that we didn't want to find out. As Josh amended the map that I was illuminating with the lighter, we were suddenly confronted with the fact that the sounds were not imagined. Rapidly and rhythmically, we heard it. Crunch. Snap. Crunch. It seemed to be moving slightly away from us, pushing through the woods just beyond our map. It had become too dark to see. We had misjudged how long the sun would linger. Nervously, I called out. Hello? There was a brief moment of breathless tension as we lay static in the water. The silence was suddenly broken by laughter. Hello? Josh cackled. So what?
Hello, Mr. Monster in the Woods. I know you're sneaking around, but maybe you'll answer my hello. Hello?
I realized how stupid it was. Whatever animal it was, it wouldn't respond. I hadn't even realized I'd said it until afterwards, but if anything was actually there, I obviously wouldn't get a reply. Josh continued, hello, in a high falsetto.
Hello,
I countered in a deep baritone as I could manage.
Hello there, mate. Hello, beep, boop. Hello,
we continued mocking each other and were in the process of turning the raft around to head back when we heard,
hello.
It was whispered, enforced as if it were powered by the last breath of a pair of dying, deflated lungs, but it didn't sound sickly. It had come from the spot just off the map, which now sat behind us since we had turned the raft around. I slowly shifted on the raft and faced the direction of the sound, and as I fumbled with the Roman candle, I wanted to see. What are you doing? Josh hissed. But I had already lit it. As the sparking fuse sunk into the wrapper, I held it towards the sky. I'd never actually shot one of these myself and thought that it just worked like a flare in the movies. A glowing green orb rocketed towards the stars and then quickly extinguished. I lowered my arm towards the horizon. I could remember that it was several colors, but I couldn't remember how many times one of these fired before being depleted. A second ball of red light burst out and fizzled above the trees. I still saw nothing.
Look, let's just go, man.
Josh pressed, as he turned to face the direction back home and began paddling desperately. Just one more. Lowering my arm directly at the woods in front of me, another red ball of fire launched from the tube. It traveled straight ahead until it collided with a tree, briefly exploding the light in a much greater diameter. Still nothing. I dropped the firework in the water and watched as one more struggling fireball burst free, only to quickly die, suffocating by the water. As we began paddling in the direction towards my house, as we heard loud and unconcealed rustling in the woods, the breaking of branches and the trampling of fallen trees overpowered by the sound of our splashing. It was running. In our panic, we jostled the raft way too violently, and I felt one of the ropes under my chest loosen. Josh, be careful! But it was too late. The raft was breaking. Before too long, it had completely fallen apart. We each held on to a separate piece of styrofoam, but the pieces weren't big enough to keep us completely afloat, and our legs dangled beneath us in the winter water. Josh, quick! I yelled as I pointed at the water right next to him. He scrambled, but it was too cold to move quickly, and we both watched as the map floated away.
I'm cold, man, Josh stuttered dejectedly. Let's get out of water.
We approached the shore, but each time we attempted to pull ourselves up, we'd hear the frantic rustling thundering towards us from the woods just above. Eventually, we were too cold and weak to even try anymore. Steadily, we kicked our legs and found ourselves nearing the dock site. We toppled off the debris and tried to pull into the land, but Josh's piece slipped away and floated in the direction of the lake. We took off our swim trunks and were desperate to get into dry clothes to shield us from the biting cold of the air. I slid on my shorts, but there was something wrong. I turned to Josh. Where's my shirt, man? He shrugged and suggested maybe he got knocked in the water and floated into the lake. I told Josh to go back to my house and to say that we were playing hide-and-seek if my mom was home. I had to try to find my shirt. I ran back to my house and peered out over the water, scouting along the shoreline. It occurred to me, with any luck, maybe I could find the map too. I was moving pretty fast because I needed to get home, and I was about to give up when my concentration was interrupted by a sound coming up from just behind me.
Hello.
I whipped around. It was Mrs. Maggie. I'd never seen her at night before, and in this poor light, she looked exceedingly frail. The usual warmth that wrapped her manner seemed to have been snuffed out by the chill. I couldn't remember ever seeing her without a smile, and so her face looked strange.
Oh. Hello, Mrs. Maggie.
Oh, hi, Chris.
The warmth and smile had returned to her, even if her memories had not.
I couldn't see it was you in the dark there.
Jokingly, I asked her if she was going to invite me in for a snack, but she said maybe another time. I was too busy looking for my map and a shirt that I really didn't engage her, but she sounded happy, so I didn't feel bad. She said a couple of other things too, but I was too distracted to pay attention. I said goodnight. I ran down her driveway toward my house, and behind me I could hear her walking across the frozen yard. I didn't turn around to wave. I had to get home. I made it home a couple minutes before my mom did, and by the time she came in, Josh and I had already changed clothes and warmed up. We'd gotten away with it, even though we'd lost the map. You couldn't find it?
Nah, but I saw Mrs. Maggie. She called me Chris again. I'm telling you, dude, just be glad that you never seen her at night.
We both laughed, and he asked me if she invited me in for a snack, joking that the snacks must have been terrible since she couldn't even give them away. I told him that she didn't, and he was surprised. And now that I had time to think about it, so was I. But literally, every time we'd ever seen her, she had invited us in for a snack, and here, you know, I had, albeit sarcastically, invited myself. She said no. As Josh talked more about Mrs. Maggie, I suddenly realized that the lighter might still be in my pocket, and that it would be disastrous if my mom were to find it. So I grabbed the shorts off the floor, patted my pockets, and I found something, but it wasn't the lighter. From my back pocket, I slid out a folded piece of paper, and my heart leapt. It's the map! I thought. But I watched it float away. And as I unfolded the paper, my stomach turned, as I tried to understand what I was seeing. Drawn on the paper, inside of a large oval, were two stick figures, holding hands. One was much bigger than the other, but neither of them had faces. The paper was torn, so a part of it was missing. There was a number written near the top right corner. It was either 15 or 16. I nervously handed Josh the paper and asked him if he had put the paper in my pocket at some point, but he scoffed at the idea and asked me why I was so upset, and I pointed towards the smaller stick figure and what was written next to it. It was my initials. I shook it off. I told Josh the rest of the conversation between Mrs. Maggie and I had always attributed the odd exchange to her being sick, until revisiting the events in my mind all these years ago. And as I think about it now, the feeling of profound sadness for Mrs. Maggie returns. But it's augmented by a looming feeling of despair when I think about why she said maybe another time. See, I know what she had said, but I didn't understand what it meant that night. I didn't understand what her words had meant weeks later. When I watched men in strange orange biohazard suits carry what I thought were black bags full of garbage out of her house, or why the whole neighborhood smelled like death that day. I still didn't understand when they condemned the house and boarded it up a little while before we moved, but I understand now. I understand why her last words to me were so important, even if neither she nor I realized it at the time. Mrs. Maggie had told me that night that Tom had come home. She told me that Tom had come home. But I know now who really moved in. Just as I know now why I never saw her body brought out on a stretcher. Those bags weren't filled with garbage.